Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Blister Podcast on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, and you can check out everything we're doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. So as skiers, snowboarders, and people who are always recreating outdoors, the changing climate is an issue that is at the forefront of many of our minds. If we really care about these issues, should we all be pooping in buckets? More on that in a minute. Or, yeah, what should we be doing to most significantly and quickly improve the current situation? Last month at our Blister Summit 2024, I led a conversation with professional skier Amy Engerbretson, Dr. Len Nesifer, who is the founder of Natives Outdoors and the Sonoran Avalanche Center, and Jake Black, who is the Senior Director of Programs for Protect Our Winners, to address these questions and a whole lot more. I think this is a really important conversation, and I think it's a pretty different climate conversation that maybe you're used to hearing. I'm proud of this one, and I think it provides a lot of food for thought and hopefully clarifies some issues for a number of us as we try to figure out what is the most significant thing each of us can be doing right now. And so let's get to my conversation with Amy and Len and Jake. Here we go. All right, well, I am very happy to be here for another Blister Summit panel session. This one we're calling Climate Issues, Individual Behavior and Collective Action. And I think to get started, let's go ahead and just do some brief introductions here with our very distinguished group of panelists. I'm just kidding. They're not that distinguished, but they're all really awesome. So,
My name is Amy Engerbretson. I'm a professional skier from Lake Tahoe, California, and I am on the Protect Our Winners Athlete Alliance and have been for a while. And I made a crazy climate change documentary called The Hypocrite that we're going to watch later and we're going to talk about.
Hi, my name is Len Nesifer. I'm two hats, owner and founder of Natives Outdoors. We're a media and film production company, and also the chief facet officer of the Sonoran Avalanche Center. Who here has heard of the Avalanche Center? Yeah, there we go. Have many hats prior to this, worked in government, the Department of Energy, working on climate change issues in Alaska Native villages. So I got to see 2016, like villages melting into the ocean, which was kind of eye-opening. Became a professor, taught students, and left because I kind of had questions about whether institutions are really where change happens. But I'm also a member of the POW Athlete Alliance as well, and kind of do, I guess I'm in the Ski Alliance, but I kind of do everything, so. I'm on the Meme Alliance, there it is.
All right, well that's a tough act to follow. Hey everyone, I'm Jake Black. I'm the Senior Director of Programs at POW, so I'm the stunt man here. But no, not really. I grew up actually in Summit County, so over in Keystone, Colorado, and grew up snowboarding, and my, you know, life led me to this organization, POW, that Jeremy Jones started as, well, actually just raise show of hands. I'm sure this crowd's familiar, but how many of you have heard of POW before? Oh, this is gonna be easy. Just kidding. We're happy to talk through this, and yeah, POW, we're hoping to engage all of you to be effective advocates, so I'm just honored to be here with these special guests.
So one of the things that, again, credit to Amy's film to help crystallize some of these things that I was thinking about, I think less clearly, was what I started thinking of is perhaps misplaced guilt when it comes to the issue of kind of individual behavior, right? Again, our two sides. There's what do I do with my own personal life, my own actions, versus the things that we talk about a good amount with climate issues, like go vote, you know, and that kind of thing. But we need everybody to do that. And I started thinking about this a bit on this notion of misplaced guilt, that it started to have certain resonances for me of certain religious traditions where there are, say, notions of like original sin, right? we all, by existing and breathing, like, we have a carbon footprint, right? And I bet a lot of people in this room have thought about that. I need to reduce my carbon footprint, those kinds of things. We maybe at times feel very guilty about some of the things we're doing. And I'm just going to stop there and actually turn this over, because I want to hear what these three folks have to say, if that makes sense, if you all have been thinking about that a lot more clearly or a lot longer than I have. But does that resonate, this notion of misplaced guilt?
I'm going to start with another audience question. How many of you in this room feel like you have the tools to be, and you are allowed to be, a climate advocate? So less than a fifth of this room. Is that because you feel like the lifestyle that you live has an impact, and because of that, that means that you're not capable of speaking up for something like climate? We got a couple of nods. That's an overwhelming resonance with that point of, like, we all feel hypocritical and we're not sure that we're allowed to speak up on these things because of the way that we live, because we like to ski, because you eat a cheeseburger, because you drive a truck, because you have a snowmobile, because you flew. But my job and what I'm here to tell you is that does not matter. You should be able to speak up for those things because it's something you care about. It's something that you believe in, something that you love, and that you should speak up and work to protect those things. So
I kind of reject the premise of original sin. My Navajo background, we don't have that view of the world, but my other side of the family does. And so it's been kind of funny to always compare and contrast. I think the amount of hand-wringing that happens around the guilt, and it's like, well, we can hand-wring or we can do something about it. And I think the more that I've spent in academia and studied and blah, 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 really what I've learned is that we're a part of much larger systems than ourselves that have existed long before we have been alive and will exist much longer after we will be alive. But the thing is that collective action and the action that we can take together as communities can change the directions of how things operate. And so, you know, one of the things that I always say, especially in systems of whatever, our economic system, whatever it may be, like, it's almost counterproductive to point at someone and say, you're the problem, or your issue's the problem, because in reality, one person doesn't control a system.
Yeah, this is going to be like a spoiler alert for the film or whatever, but we'll kind of like jump into it. And I think, like, when we look at society and the world and history, some of the most powerful controlling emotions are shame and guilt. And we see that across like all facets of our life and throughout all of history, really. And it's funny that you pick up on the religious element there. In my film, I interview this woman named Naomi Oreskes, and she is a Harvard professor, and she studies the history of science, which is super fascinating right now when we're in this new era of not believing science, not believing data. Like, whoa. And she wrote this fascinating book called Merchants of Doubt, that when I was introduced to Naomi through Pow and watched her movie and read her book, I was blown away. And what she unveils in this book is that this idea of the individual carbon footprint, and before that, the idea of even climate denial, because back in the 80s, there was pretty good agreement that climate change was happening. And the disagreement was how fast and what to do about it. And sometime after then, the fossil fuel industry got together, and what Naomi talks about in this film, in this book, is that they basically went to the tobacco industry and what's been called the tobacco playbook for public misinformation. And the fossil fuel industry hired the exact same PR company that worked for the tobacco industry and applied that playbook of public misinformation to the climate world, first creating climate denial, kind of seeding that, and then when they realized that wasn't working very well, really shifting focus and putting a lot of weight behind this idea of the individual carbon footprint. And there's actually a line, there's public documents from these meetings about what went on with this PR firm, and there's a line in one of the documents that said, we'll use, this isn't a direct quote, but it basically was saying that it's going to use the persuasion of guilt adapted from the Christian religious system to influence people, which is fascinating. And it works very well, right? It's such an amazing tool. Yeah. And so in my film, we kind of talk about that. Naomi's in my film. I was privileged to interview her when she emailed me back and said, yeah, she'd be part of the film. I almost died. But it was kind of eye-opening to realize that this way we think, where we are so wrapped up in like this individual guilt that's actually shame, that like the way we think about this issue and the way we behave around this issue is actually the product of millions, if not billions, of dollars in marketing from the fossil fuel industry. And I know that sounds crazy. I know that sounds inflammatory, but it's fact. There's public document data. And again, if you're subscribing to the notion that we believe in science and we believe in data, like this is what's out there. And I think when I learned that, a lot of things started to click. And I found the premise of this film, I made The Hypocrite, is I made a snowmobile climate change film. And this idea that we're wasting so much energy, like this whole conversation is about energy, right? And one of those energies is human energy. And I have come to this realization that we're wasting our cherished human energy blaming each other, pointing fingers at each other, fighting about the wrong things, when what we really need to do is conserve that energy and apply it towards the real issue, the meat of the issue, and where we can actually make a direct change in that issue as quickly as possible. Every ounce of carbon matters. Every ton of carbon matters, don't get me wrong. If we, in the IPCC, the recent, most recent version of the IPCC, there's a whole section that maps out that individual action enough isn't going to make a dent in this problem. Political will is the only way, and that's our systems. That's changing the systems. That's making those changes equitable to all. You know, climate change disproportionately affects people of color and minorities greatly. And I know, like, we sit up here in a place of privilege saying, like, hey, we're worried about our winters. It's a lot more than that. But it's, like, that kind of realization to me of, like, okay, I didn't even know. Like, I've just been thinking about this whole individual carbon footprint thing, and I didn't even know why. And I'm letting that wrap me up. And what ultimately, like, we have this idea that you have to be perfect to be a climate advocate, right? Like, you have to be perfect. You have to bike everywhere. You have to have an electric car. You never fly. You're a vegan. And I don't know about you guys, but in any walk of my life, if I strive for perfection, I end up completely paralyzed. And I think that's what we face in, like, this climate advocacy space.
Preach. I'd say on top of that, to your point of, well, one, there's no such thing as perfection in this. Nobody has a perfect footprint. The systems that we live in, it's not possible. But on top of that, what happens is we're probably all in here on the same side. We probably all want to protect the things that we got to do today, to get out and ski, to enjoy these things with our friends, to build community. That's the point of this summit. But what ends up happening is we find these fissions and these divisions of, like, well, you're not vegan, we're not on the same team. Oh, but you drive a truck, you're my enemy. And that's not true. We have so much more in common with each other than we have apart. And the more that we stay apart, the more that we will continue to perpetuate a system that doesn't allow us to have options to choose a different way of living. But if we can find ways to come together, and that's what we're striving to do with POW, and what why I'm so motivated by it, and the people that we get to work with, and the community that it builds, is because it is, hey, we want to talk about how we can protect these places, the things we love to do, but we're talking about using those passions so that we can help other people around the world. Because it's not, if we lose snow, that's the least of our worries as a society. I mean, this summer, people in Phoenix were living with 119 degree temperatures, and they don't have AC or infrastructure or anything like that. Like,
we can handle it.
Okay, he's from Tucson. Take it with a grain of salt.
All right. So, I would melt.
Let me try to stay on this for a second. When you said that's not true, right? And Jake, we were talking about this last night, the 4%. And I want to get back to this because this I think really matters. But let's just extrapolate. When we were saying, oh, well, you know, I don't live this perfect life. Let's say I do. Like, okay, what does that even mean? Like, so I have a zero carbon footprint, or there's an acceptable number that still hits perfection? Like, let's play this out. I don't know what that means, but let's say I am perfect. Ladies and gentlemen, good news. This guy. Now let's
God,
say.
God, is that you?
Yeah, yeah. Now let's say that you all are, you know, bright enough to follow my perfect example, and we get 50 million people to also be perfect, that doesn't change the actual problem. It doesn't change, like, we can now get real self-righteous. And this leads me into kind of the next thing I've been thinking about. We started with misplaced guilt, and now I want to talk a little bit about, like, misplaced pride. So I'm up here perfect, feeling pretty good about myself. I've changed nothing, right? I've changed nothing. And if 50 million of us led that perfect, we were talking about pooping in a bucket last night. We actually did talk about that. Like, so we're all doing that now, everybody, because we're the perfect ones. We are the religious, that we are the righteous 50 million. There's still energy systems much bigger than us 50 million. So I think as we play this out, I just like the idea, and I want you guys to sort of say smarter things to this, but we are making category mistakes here. We are making category mistakes here. So if we don't care about that, and if we don't actually care about real change, but what we really want is to think that, like, you know, I'm better than you and you and you because I'm, like, I have whatever that fake carbon perfect footprint is that doesn't actually make any sense. Do you know what I mean? So that, I think, is something that I haven't heard a lot of talk about. Like, even if we scaled out these perfect lifestyles, that category mistake, please take it from there.
Well, I'll tell the pooping in the bucket story.
I was going to say,
It
was just bonding.
Yeah, I mean, there's some folks that I know in my life that have chosen to live like an ascetic, you know, basically shunning anything that's related to plastics, to carbon emissions, to whatever it may be. They're living in indigenous communities in Mexico, and, you know, when they come to the U.S., basically, they'll shut off the water in whatever house that they're living in because they don't believe running water is a sustainable thing, and so they'll poop in a bucket. So, you know, imagine having your relatives bury their poop in your backyard. It's kind of a weird scene. But, you know, they've taken that path of saying, I'm going to live to the extreme. If you all want to, like, go down that road of living the extreme, go at it. But it ends up being a really, in my opinion, kind of a selfish endeavor, and one that then also starts putting a lot of these onuses and burdens on those around them. And I think that becomes a larger question of, okay, this systems level thinking. You remember when we all had to hang out inside during the pandemic? I don't know, you might know the numbers of this, Jake. When the actual reduction in carbon emissions from that month that the world was stuck inside was like 20%. It wasn't 50, it wasn't 80. And what that pointed to is that the systems that are just, they just churn and run on themselves, energy systems, transportation systems, whatever it may be, there's so much embedded carbon usage within those systems that the systems need to change. And so whether our one little drop in the bucket, it really doesn't make a difference. And it's something you should be concerned about. But I think one of the things is that it's also, you know, having studied externalities and what that means in an economic sense, externalities are basically unintended bad consequences of an action, right? So we fly on a plane, it emits carbon, you get a heavy dose of radiation from the sun, which is a whole different cosmic radiation. We can go into a whole conversation.
Did he mention that. He's a doctor?
But, you know, there's a whole plethora of ways in which every transaction, economic transaction, the thing that we do in the world, there's this cascading chain of externalities that we never see, but it's easy to glom onto the ones that we know about. And I mean, a great one is fashion. The clothing industry is like the largest, second largest producer of waste in the world. There's a waste site that I went in Chile. It's like literally a mountain of discarded clothes that's out in the Atacama Desert. That is stuff that just gets discarded because it's not useful.
It caught on fire.
That's good. Even better. But the other is that the dyes and the fabrics that we use, I mean, it's the number one polluter of waterways in the world. And so if you ever buy a new piece of clothing, or just anything that you do, there's this cascading line of impacts, and you just have to realize that. And it's just like at a certain point, it's like, well, like my one little action isn't going to change the system because there's going to be 10, you know, 5 billion more people that are going to do it anyway. And so that's kind of where I start looking at what are the levers that we can begin to change the systems. And really that begins with policies. And I hate to bring it back to politics, but policies matter. But in a similar way to your point about perfectionism, politics and policies are so fucking imperfect. And it's, you know, the one thing that I look at my very religious right side of the family for is that they've been living with imperfection because they see the larger goal. And that as long as they're taking a forward step towards whatever their goals are, which I still don't understand, you know, they see that as a win. And I think what I see in a lot on in the realm of climate change and whatever it may be, especially in the left politics, is that we're always wanting the perfect. And in many ways, that stops us from just seeing these little wins. And I guess the one that, I mean, Jake can talk to this more, but we had the largest climate bill get passed in our history, the infrastructure or the Inflation Reduction Act. And the one figure that I saw was, you know, 100, 150 electric vehicle chargers are getting installed every day in this country after the passage of that law. 150 times 365 is, you know, 400,000 EV chargers. And so we're in the midst of a massive change in our energy system as a result of a very imperfect bill. And I always look at that as that that's a step forward, and that's what we need to focus on, as like just celebrating the small wins where we can get them.
And I mean, I will respond to this from like my personal story on this, meaning so this guilt is what's driven me towards this direction. But at first what it was, okay, Jake, you love to snowboard. I used to compete snowboarding in Summit County for a really long time. And I started to just really get down on myself because, okay, everything that you're doing is having an impact. So you need to change your life. You need to change everything that you're doing. So I would change my diet. I stopped flying. I would stop, I would bike pretty much as I can. I would reuse my water bottle, my whatever. I would take shorter showers. I would do all of these things. And I never felt like it was enough, not once, because it was overwhelming with how like how much of a burden it was laying on me. Then I met I met many of the folks, but a character I'm going to bring up is Auden Schendler. He's the senior VP of Aspen Ski Company, and he brought up this analogy, which was, okay, so I'm a, you know, high executive at this big organization. We've started building everything LEED certified. We're reducing our footprint in massive ways. And then I looked at the global temperature and the temperature went up. And so we built more of those buildings next year. We doubled that. We tripled this. And I checked and the global temperature went up. And so they're doing everything they can in their direct footprint to make a difference. And the problem's getting worse. Newsflash, if the entire ski industry, if the entire outdoor industry tomorrow went carbon neutral, the problem still exists. We would be emitting more carbon and more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere every day. It is not this industry, it is not our personal footprints that are gonna get us there. And the resolve I'm gonna bring it to is the first time I ever felt relief. And I still believe this because I know everybody talks about, well, you need to be changing everything. You need to do less, change your lifestyle, you know, do all these things because that's the only way we're gonna solve it, to what Jonathan was bringing up. There's studies that show 4% of the change that we need to reach a carbon neutral future is individual action. So we're talking about 96% of the change. The first time I ever felt some resolve was engaging with an organization like POW, because I found like-minded individuals who wanted to make a difference and were coming together. And community building is climate action. Talking about this over like a panel, talking about this with your friends on a chairlift, having a meal together, bringing people in is the single largest thing you can do for the climate. And that has less to do with, like, yes, do individual things as daily reminders to help you think about, okay, why is, you know, I'm doing this because I care about these things. You don't need to take it to some absolute extreme. But the thing that I challenge everyone to bring to that extreme is, how do you bring everyone else in? How do you open that conversation, find that common ground, find these things where you start to realize, oh, and here's some more stats. There are over 50 million people in the country. That's where that number comes from, that participate in outdoor recreation. Now, I hate this analogy, but the NRA has 3-4 million members. it's impossible to move any sort of gun legislation. Imagine what a fraction of this outdoor community could do if we banded them all together and we told everybody in power that it is unacceptable to continue these systems the way that we're doing this. And that's how we get to things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which it's over $400 billion in investments to climate. We're gonna need to build at a faster rate than we did during, like in our World War II, in our industrialization. We need to scale this stuff at a faster rate than we've done that. But we can do it. We need more political will to get it there though.
I mean, I think that like something like all of that knowledge drops and stats and all that, like to add on to that, there's this professional snowboarder in Reno, Tim Eddy, and he did it. Like he's like, I'm gonna be an aesthetic. I'm gonna move to the woods. We're gonna live off grid. I'm gonna give up my snowboarding career. Da 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 da. He does it with his partner, and they do it for 4 years. And he kind of like had an epiphany where he's like, I'm just changing me, and that's like a millimeter of a drop of rain in an ocean of a problem, and it wasn't doing anything. And so he came back, he went back to his professional snowboarding career. He joined POW, he did all these things. And I think I was doing an interview earlier where like this idea came up of like, what is someone like my role in this? Like as a professional skier, in a lot of ways, like my job is to perpetuate consumerism within the snow industry, right? Like I only get like re-signed if Atomic believes that I am responsible for selling more skis, right? So like on some level, I have exponential guilt in this, right? Because I'm not only responsible for my actions, but I'm in theory, like my entire existence career-wise is to influence all of you to do things, buy things, go places, travel places, ski places. And I kind of wanted to like shift that in another perspective of like what I would hope to do and what I think POW enables me to do and what we can all do for our community is to make it this idea of citizenship is like what we're talking about. Like, are you going to be a person living alone, recluse in the woods, thinking that you're being perfect, or are you going to be a citizen and you're going to drive these systemic changes that are going to make these big, big differences, but also make these options, these choices more equitable and more available to everyone, right? Like it's a huge privilege to be able to consider your individual carbon footprint. There are the majority of the people on this planet that don't have that privilege. And so to me, like my role as an athlete is how do I make it not just cool, but kind of like the norm to be a citizen in your, whatever it is, like a citizen in our world, a citizen in your town, a citizen in your community, pushing that forward. And like, I think a lot about like the way we look at kind of what we've done in the last 15, 20 years around the backcountry. Like if you go out into the backcountry and you see somebody out there without any gear, you're like, oh, that guy's a kook. What a loser. We've decided that's not cool. And my like, hopefully not altruistic ideal or goal is that like, it's my job to start it, but you all to come with me to like, if you're an outdoor community participant and you're not a citizen, you're a kook. Like, get out of here. Like, what are you doing? And like, that is my hope of like how we can support each other in community and drive that bigger systemic change that we need versus moving to the woods, living off grid and thinking that you're perfect.
Yep. Yeah, well said. So we've talked about misplaced guilt. We've talked about misplaced pride, where I'm doing my thing, I'm good, you guys are the problem out there, right? Then I do wanna touch on something. What Amy just said is perfect, but a couple other things.
Nobody's perfect, remember, we just spent a lot of time doing that.
But two other things that I think that is just good to talk about is room for two things. Personal joys and individual principles, right? Like, I think it is actually laudable if someone's like, I have taken on a vegan diet because I can, and I just want to have my current understanding is that might amount to the, you know, the most sustainable form of eating. That's fine. And I don't want to like go after that person. we hope that person's not doing the misplaced pride category mistake that we've talked about. But I do think there needs to be room for people like, I don't drive a car, I only ride a bicycle, or I'm never on a snowmobile, or I'm never in a helicopter, or I never fly in an airplane, or the list goes literally on forever. And so I think I don't think any of us are interested in like saying your individual principles are stupid. We just want to make sure you're not making a category mistake, right? The next thing to that is like personal joys, right? Y'all traveled here and I'm really glad you did, you know? And I've had a great time getting to meet some of you and ride chairlifts with some of you and taking laps with some of you. And I think like there's also then room for that. Like, let's not do the misplaced guilt thing. No category mistakes. We're trying to rid out the category mistakes so that the things that Len likes to restore cars. That's not my bag, but like, I don't want to be in a world where like, Len, you're messing up the whole thing because you like to restore cars. More category mistakes, right? Those are just some of my thoughts. And then you guys can take that or then take it in the direction of then like, okay, so if we've weeded out the category mistakes, so then what are the meaningful things we should be doing or can be doing?
I think it's kind of like a yes and situation because I had to think about this a lot in making a film about kind of like deprioritizing individual actions, because that can be really disenfranchising, disempowering, that like nothing you do as an individual matters. And if we all sit up here and say nothing you guys do matters, like that's not it. Every pound of carbon matters for sure, and everything you do does matter. And if it suits your life to be a vegan, have an EV, whatever it might be, it's a yes and. Please do it. And make sure you're voting. Make sure that you know what's going on in whatever systems are around you, what's going on in your local election. And yes, we all know who's president matters, but all the way down the ballot matters. If you guys were here at the panel a couple nights ago, your county commissioner is actually one of the most important votes you can make. And so if you want to be a vegan, yes, and are you a citizen? Not, I'm a vegan, so I don't have to. I think that that's a place where people can be like, oh, no, I have a Tesla, like I'm good. And it's a yes and situation that I think is like really important to, again, emphasize this, hey, systemic action is where it matters, and try to de-emphasize without disenfranchising the individual. And I think that's also about kind of like this idea of like, let's just lay down our fingers for a sec, the pointing of the fingers, and let's take that energy and refocus it.
Okay, so I'll get to your second part of the question, which is like, well, what can we do about it? And what are the things that we can do? Which relates back to the individual action. I like to use an analogy that I think climate action is just like powder days, meaning not every day do the conditions line up, but it doesn't mean you can't do anything in between those storms. And so what I mean by that is, not every day is there something in your community that you're voting on or something that you're going to be standing up for or some big action that you can help bring your voice and add it to the table or speaking to an elected official or whatever it is that's going to help change the world as we know it for the better. Just like snow days. We are all waiting, hoping that we're going to get a good snow day tomorrow. But that we weren't just waiting today for that. I would imagine many of you have been taking the last few months being like, okay, it's ski season. I got to prep for this. I'm going to check out the movies. I'm going to train some more. I'm going to, get some new maps. We're going to plan a new trip. Like, these are all the things we do in preparation for the hope of these big storms. Climate action's the same thing. Every day there are those actions and things that you can do to prepare yourself, whether it's like tune in your skis, it's reading up on what's happening in your community, at the state level, at the federal level. There's all kinds of great resources. We have a ton of them on our POW website. I mentioned this briefly last night, but we just launched the new POW Climate Advocates Guidebook. Awesome resource. Tons of books, podcasts, movies, resources, everything you guys could think of that it's like, okay, what can I do for the climate? And I say it's built for everybody that's like, it's the first time you're trying to do something because you care about this, but you don't know where to start. And then the other end of the spectrum, and it's the people like Len and Amy here, who I like to say have their PhD in advocacy. And it's like, there's something that everybody can do no matter where you are on that scale. And it can be those further educating yourself actions. And then at PAL, I like to think of it as our job is we're the forecasters. We're the ones that are saying like, hey, storm is on the horizon. There's a big election happening right now. Here's an area in Alaska that you can help protect. Put your name on this, like make sure you make your voice heard or make sure you're registered to vote or whatever it is. And it's those things because we need you all at the chair for the first lift. And if we can really start to do that, I mean, holy shit, will you see change?
I've been percolating on this, trying to consolidate some thoughts. But I think one of the things, I look at is we have, I mean, aside from climate, I mean, one of the biggest things that we're facing in our society now is loneliness. Those little light boxes we got in our pockets that we hang out with is part of the reason. It's also, you know, people moving around. I mean, there's all kinds of factors that have led to loneliness, and I'm sure some of you have heard about it. If you haven't, you should look into it. But there's, you know, a lot of really gnarly things that comes out of that loneliness. And I think there's some sociologists that are saying that like a lot of the online anger and vitriol and gnarliness in part is an expression of loneliness that people are feeling. I'm totally forgetting the book's name now, but there's a book that I was reading about the rise of authoritarians. And one of the common and key themes across societies that led to the rise of authoritarianism was actually high levels of loneliness. And they did studies in like, you know, pre-Mussolini France and pre-Nazi Germany, and basically a lot of these economic factors that were marginalizing people, societal factors and things that were then leading to authoritarians. And a lot of folks would look and treat those folks, those authoritarians, as their friends. It was a, like sort of a salve for loneliness. And, you know, when we're looking at, when I start looking at climate action and whatever, it's like I do some of it online, but I've since, which I'll talk about in a second, but, you know, a lot of the work that I've been doing is trying to build community in the places that I live, of knowing neighbors. You're much more likely to survive and come out pretty well in a case of a climate disaster if you know all your neighbors. Like, it's a survival thing. Just go do it. Go have breaks and bread with those homies. The other is that, you know, we have to, you know, in living in communities, you'll inherently encounter people that are different than you. And it's much harder to be an online troll or asshole in person. Like, you're not going to say the things that you would type on online to some, you know, throwing out into the ether to someone that's sitting right in front of you. And I think one of the things is that being proactive and building that community, I think it's a long project, and it's also might not work, but it's something to think about in your own life of like, what are the ways that I can engage in my community? It doesn't have to be politics, but is it just like, having a set time to make meals with folks or to, you know, I mean, skiing, backcountry skiing is a great example of where you can help build community there. For me, my personal action in terms of building community is this insane for-profit avalanche center thing that I started, right? Really the Sonoran Avalanche Center came out of a place of just being, you know, I'm trained in academic writing and talking to policymakers and whatever. And then, you know, posted anything online about climate and someone said, that's all bullshit. After I've spent, you know, 12, 13 years getting to this point of expertise just to be totally dismissed. And I kind of was looking at, well, maybe who are the folks that are trusted in this online environment space? Avalanche forecasters are 1 degree separate from climate scientists. Like, they're out there measuring changes in the climate and what's happening. You don't see that level of vitriol and distrust and, you know, conspiracies pointed towards avalanche centers. And you don't see that pointed towards avalanche forecasters. And I think in a real way, it's because there's been a community that's been built around it where, one, people can participate in the process, submit their own observations, be a part of the science, and actually go out and see what's happening, right? And so I, you know, in creating the Sonoran Avalanche Center, I was like, well, let's get ahead of this issue and create our own conspiracies and just be in cahoots with the avalanche forecasters. And so we basically said that, you know, the largest ski company in the world invented facets so more people would ski in bounds. Profit motive. And we have a profit motive in that as well, because it turns out conspiracies make money. But really, part of that is you know, that platform of like poking fun at conspiracies, at this insanity that we're seeing in the world, is also creating community. And creating a community of folks that kind of see what's going on in the world but don't really know what to do about it, because it feels so overwhelming. Because it's like, how do you even begin to talk to someone that's denying that climate change is even real, or someone's creating it? And it's like, well, we have our own conspiracy, and it's kind of fun. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny, and like creating that community. I mean, we've actually just like kind of the funny thing of creating community is that there's like 4 relationships that we've set up, like through people, through the SAC network. But you know, it's like, that's kind of the funny thing of creating community, is that you have all these other blossoming things that can come from it. But you know, that's been my way of also just dealing with the guilt and grief of you know, how do I even begin to use my skills, like having gotten a doctorate, in this world that doesn't really trust or see what I know or understand in a valuable way. And so it's like turning it on its head and building a community in a chaotic and kind of crazy way.
And being creative about it.
Let's open things up for a few questions.
Yeah, so cool. I mean, it's been really, really awesome to hear you guys speak. I was involved with PAL like in skiing, and it's been interesting to kind of take a step away and to feel the fatigue that comes with the climate fight and with a lot of activism. And something that I came at, well, I'm like, okay, we have to get involved in the systems, and then also the corporations are driving so much, which is why like I love Fat Tire, the corporations that are really taking upon positive change. But in my time away, I came across this woman. I think it was during COVID, and there was this idea of the social ecosystem map, and it's like that all of us play different roles in activism, and like we all have stronger parts of our personality. Like some of us are, you know, I just pulled it up earlier, but it's like we all have shared values, and like I think all of humanity has shared values. And it was really cool for me to realize, like, yeah, somebody is going to be really good at being a disruptor. I am not, even though I have a platform for it. And PAL really helped me with being like, okay, like, what's your lever? How do you use your lever? And I'm like, okay, well, my lever is that I have a voice, but I'm not a disruptor. And so how do I use what's, like, inherent in here, my own gifts, to do it? And I've been really thinking on that. And, you know, there's visionaries, builders, experimenters, there's a whole thing. Social ecosystem map. I encourage you to like Google it and check it out. But my question for you guys is that what I really feel and see is the divide that is like so prevalent, and the ways that we alienate each other. And it's like, I get so hopeless when I see that if we can't find a way to at least share the things that we love or value about being human and being alive and being on this planet. Like in Utah, when I was involved in advocacy, it was like, everybody hates the dirty air. Like it fucking sucks. Kids are getting asthma, is awful. And so it didn't matter what side of the political spectrum you landed on. It was like, we all wanted to clean the air, and we had like a shared motive. And so I've just been really thinking about connecting around shared values with people that are a part, like on a way different part of the spectrum, whether they're a Trump supporter or they don't ski, and the importance of like finding that and working with that. And I'm just curious if you guys, like in your own hearts or in your own lives, how you think about, or if you have like good, like a good story of connecting with someone that felt so different from you and being able to cut through the riffraff of alienation or like polarization, and finding that connection and what that looks like and what that feels like, or the space that you hold for that in your lives. I'm just curious, like your guys' thoughts and feelings and experience with this.
I can start with a short story. If you guys were there for my impromptu monologue last night, you heard a bit of it. Totally. And I think that like one of the hopes is that you know, the joy, a lot of us here, like our primary joy, at least this season, is sliding on snow. But that joy we all derive from the outdoors is, I think, super pervasive among humanity. And that's like, what? Why are we working so hard to preserve this world? And like, yes, it's to exist and to work and to all these things, but really it's to enjoy our lives. And I think there's a lot of people around the world where that enjoyment does come from being in the outdoors in whatever way makes sense to them. I had this experience with Protect Our Winters. I've been able to go to DC and lobby a few times, and I feel super out of place on Capitol Hill and in a pantsuit. Not my vibe. And my first trip there, I fucking really scared, to be honest with you. I was like, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. And we had this meeting one of the afternoons with a Republican congressman from Florida. And I'm from California. And I was like, oh my God, like what's gonna happen? Like I had all these ideas in my head. I'm like, oh, this is gonna be so bad, so intimidating. It's gonna be heated. He's probably going to make me seem dumb and like I don't know if I'm going to stay to my talking points. And what happened, you know, we go into this meeting and I had all these things in my head. I was really nervous. I felt like it was going to be bad. I felt like I had nothing in common with a Republican from Florida, right? Like that's just what I thought. And we kind of have this way of starting conversations of like starting kind of with like our connection with the outdoors. And we kind of immediately jumped into his connection with the Everglades and my connection with the mountains. And he didn't ski. I've never been to the Everglades, but kind of immediately in this stuffy room in Washington, D.C., there was like that sparkle in his eye and that sparkle in my eye. And we realized that whatever he's getting out of like what he's doing is the same as what I get out of being in the mountains and skiing. And like we immediately connected on that. And it was so eye-opening because I had so many preconceived notions before I went into that meeting. And what happened was the space, like in that meeting, like after we kind of like level set a little bit of like, oh, like there's that spark of joy that it exists in both of us. We both have it. It looks different, but we both have it. And then there was this space, this relief to have this conversation that felt productive. And my walls dropped, his walls dropped. And there was this commonality that we found, this common ground, you know, literally the ground, the earth that we all do these fun things on, whatever they might be. And I felt like that was like a pretty fundamentally like eye-opening experience for me in terms of trying to broach the issue of extreme division and polarization that is just surrounding this issue completely. So that story was, I mean, it was a crazy experience for me for sure.
I think one of the things that comes to mind is like, I think of even just the division that we have right now is the result of a system, and it's called algorithms. Like, there's, I mean, you can go down the rabbit hole, but basically Facebook in the early 2010s changed their algorithm to try to get more engagement so it'd get more people to be online so they could sell more ads, blah, blah, blah. But basically then began feeding the most controversial content to people, the most controversial messages, and that's still a part of that algorithm today. And it's pretty amazing. There's been some folks that I've known in my life that have some pretty extreme views on stuff. And the minute they set down the phone for like a month, they're like a different person. Or they shut off Fox News. You just pick, choose your, you know, whatever. Choose your algorithm. And I think that's one of the things that's like kind of one of the invisible forces in our society that we don't really think about in terms of what's shaping our perception of the world. And also how we engage with others. And I think more and more, I'm just like kind of done with it. And it's a powerful tool, but it has a lot of drawbacks and a lot of things that are really screwing with our society. And I think really like what started breaking down for me, I mean, I've lived in political division in my own family for a long freaking time. And, you know, I think about some of my cousins. Oh God, I don't even know where to begin with them. He was the chief of staff for like the most conservative member of the Michigan House and was a part of the, I don't know if you remember seeing the riots and take over the Michigan Capitol. He was involved in that. So we're pretty far apart on some of these things. But we love cars. We love fixing cars. I mean, you can look at my hands. My hands are scarred from cars. And it's funny because in that community, people are like, oh, you have a doctorate. You don't know how to work with your hands. And I was like, the hell I do. And yeah. And, you know, that's one of the like that's one of the things that ties us together, because what we do have in common is we do come from the same class background. We come from blue collar families, and working on cars is what you do to save money. And it also, for some of us, has turned into a passion and a hobby. And that's one of those areas, you know, and I raced cars before and, you know, basically spent a lot of time with people who are very politically different. But that sort of space, we have very few of those common spaces where we can interact with strangers around a shared love. And I think there's, you know, many ways that we can begin looking at that, and how do we build that in our own communities, in our own lives. And I think really when we begin to see that, you know, really at the end of the day, most people are concerned about the same things. It's just the approaches that we wish to address them are different. And that's where the politics differ.
I mean, I'll start it off with, I started volunteering for PAL a decade ago. I've been working for PAL for about 8 years. I don't know if I've ever convinced anybody to change sides. So, I mean, I say that as like, that's not the goal. The goal is not necessarily you need to like convince everybody who has a different ideology or outlook to think exactly like you do. That's what's so amazing about our society, is we have so many different perspectives, and by considering and talking and learning from one another, we can find better solutions, I think. But that's not to say that this isn't really hard emotional things to take on. I mean, when we're talking about kind of like an existential, I mean, not just kind of, we're talking about an existential crisis of like, will we be able to live on this planet for generations? The planet's going to be fine. It's the question of like, will the human species be on here? But with that, where I have found the most inspiration, the motivation to continue to do these things, is by sharing stories. It's telling your experiences. It's talking about and finding those things that you have in common with each other. And just another stat I'll share. So we like to call the 50 million people, the 50 plus million people that participate in outdoor recreation in this country, the outdoor state. That's bigger than any one state. That's bigger than New York, California. It's not defined by borders or party lines. I can tell you, we know statistically, 40% of the outdoor states liberal, 30% of the outdoor states Republican, 30% of the outdoor states independent. We do not all think the same. So just like we are a mixed pot of individuals. We have different opinions, but the way that we're going to find solutions through this is by coming together, by sharing our stories. And this great professor, this course I've taken with, his name's Marshall Gantz. He teaches public narrative at Harvard. And his whole concept, he helped with the farm labor movement in the 60s in helping elevate farm labor laws in California, but which changed them around the country. And they were the underdogs. And their whole philosophy was, well, we can identify the problem and we can identify the solution. But how do you get from a problem to a solution? You have to develop motivation. And the way you develop motivation is through storytelling. And it's talking about who you are, helping people understand what makes you tick, why you care about these things. You don't need to be a climate expert to talk about this stuff. You need to be able to talk about your experience. Nobody can belittle or discredit when you've seen something or when you've had this feeling or this change or this problem that you've experienced in your life. That helps people understand you. Then we find out there's a lot that we together have shared values on. This room specifically, we all love to go play in the mountains. We're probably all here because we're seeking community. We're here because I love to ski, but I also like to make friends that I can go ski with, because we have shared values in that sense, and that there's a lot that we can do together. And the other part, then it's talking about like, well, what can we do about it? Well, there's a lot we can do, and we have to figure out how to come together to implement these solutions. And yeah, I find that to be like, I mean, there are such heavy days talking about this subject, but that's not our approach. Like, the approach is like, you can take a fear-based tactic. There are a lot that do this, and fear, it's very well known. If you lead with shame and guilt and fear, it's action, it inhibits action. It keeps you from wanting to do something. But if you can share a story that makes someone feel, I mean, anger can be a tactic, actually, but if you can share stories that make someone feel like they can make a difference, or that what they do matters, or that there's something that they can do to help someone else, that's inspiring. I mean, and that's a power that I believe we all have.
At 9 o'clock tonight, we're going to say 9:10. We're keeping it real. 9:10, we're hitting start on Amy's film upstairs, 26-minute film. Like I said, this panel session was very much inspired by that film. I look forward to many of you seeing it tonight. And I very much appreciate, for my own reasons, having you weigh in on some of those things that I've been kind of thinking through, these notions of misplaced guilt, misplaced pride, category mistakes that we're making. And I think that, I think for myself and hopefully for some of you, those things actually really help make sense of understanding or thinking more clearly about our individual behaviors and then what we can do and why we should care so much about that collective action.
Can I just jump in with like a couple more things?
Absolutely.
I listened to the panel that Lynn was on the other night, and I had some things like swimming by that they'll be in the film. We lay them out in graphics. But I think one thing that created a lot of hope in me is we think like, oh, we're just skiers. Like, what are we going to do? We're just skiers. It's the fossil fuel industry. What are we going to do? And I learned that economically, if you were to round up the entire outdoor industry, and I'm casting a huge net here, fishers, anglers, mountain bikers, everything, the whole outdoor industry, but this doesn't include like ball sports and stuff, but outdoors, that economic driver, that contribution annually to the annual GDP in the USA, that contribution of the outdoor industry is double every year what the extraction component of the fossil fuel industry contributes to the GDP. We're part of a powerful community. Like, that's inspiring to me. Like, we are not just a bunch of hippies in the woods. Like, we're talking about money. We're talking about jobs. We're talking about an industry, if it went away, would have massive trickle-down effects to our entire economy. The outdoor industry is bigger than the pharmaceutical industry. Is it a bigger group of people to unify? Absolutely. But I think that that's something that is so cool to hear and understand, that like, okay, we should unify and be communities, but also when we do, we have this huge potential that's totally untapped. And I find that really inspiring. And I think that that's a place where I derive a lot of hope, that it's like, I have so much faith in my community, like this community, like we seek out pain and hard stuff, and we love type 2 and even type 3 fun. What the heck? We can do hard things. That's our MO. And something, I said it last night again, if you were there at my impromptu TED talk, but something that stuck with me so hard is pessimism is lazy. Nobody in this room is lazy, right? Like, that's not why you're here. And so it feels like this like oppressive, oh my God, it's so hard and we can't do it and we don't matter. We do. We're a huge part of this economy. We have a crazy intense passion that makes us do borderline crazy things. We're not lazy, right? And we have this insane passion inside of us. And I think that that's what can be activated. And that's what gives me hope, remembering those things, realizing those things, and sharing those things.
And a plug I want to make for my mentor, who here knows Luis Benitez? No. Former director of the OREC office here in Colorado. I hope he runs for Senate. He has a book coming out. You can pre-order. It's called Higher Ground, but it literally speaks to this specific issue of the untapped power of the outdoor industry in shaping politics. And this guy is the thought leader. He's lobbying, you know, to get a federal office of outdoor rec, all kinds of things. Worth your time, worth your read, and, you know, he needs to sell some books, so.
All right, well, I guess my closing thoughts are, we're talking big change, but this big change happens at the margins. There are often these elections that we work on where people win or lose by 5 votes. Sometimes that's the difference. It's the same analogy that we see in whatever, everything that we do. Ski races are won by hundredths of a second. Climbing a mountain can be that tiny little move that makes a difference that you can get to the top of that. It's not about totally upending everything you're doing and going all in. I mean, I'm all in on this, but it's not about like, okay, it's got to be these extremes. We have to have all 50 million people. No, it's these small wins along the way. So like, take that, learn to, I guess, engage in these small wins, get engaged in your communities. And I guess my final question for all of you is, after listening to this, how many of you who didn't feel like they could be an advocate for the climate feel like you can be an advocate for the climate now? All right.
Thanks to all of you.
and thanks to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Blister Podcast. I want to say thanks to Amy and Len and Jake for the conversation. Thanks to Taylor Ahern for producing this episode. And thanks to you for listening. And if you appreciate different conversations like this, I hope you would take a moment to leave us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, and just let us know that, and we will continue to have conversations about things that we think are important and what we can do on those topics. All right, everybody. Thank you. Talk to you real soon.